I'm Ryan Jeffrey, and this is the Passionate About OSS podcast. The purpose of the podcast is to shine a light on the brilliant minds of the OSS and telco industry, to describe some of their background, but also to share some of their knowledge, tips, and techniques with you, the audience. Today's episode, we'll take a look at using modern OSS BSS architectures to get offerings to market quickly. Today's guest has a deep affinity for OSS BSS. He's been providing architectural and product leadership for over 30 years and has worked across many different facets of OSS, BSS and telco, which we'll get to a little bit later. He's a founding director and CEO of Digit, a provider of OSS and BSS solutions as well. He was head of systems architecture and technology, a role that had complete responsibility for the design and delivery of NBN Co's Greenfields OSS. And he's also one of TM Forum's most active participants, especially here in the APAC region. I'm delighted to have him on this episode because he's a real leading architectural thinker and strategist around new generation BSS in particular. So welcome today to Greg Dilton.
Thank you, Ryan. It's nice to be on.
Fantastic. So, Greg, did your telco journey begin at Telstra, like so many other telco experts here in Australia?
Absolutely, Ryan. I was lured into Telstra when the tech boom was happening in the late 90s. So I was working in enterprise IT prior to that, and the internet was really taking off. So I thought, I better become part of this internet thing. So I got myself a role as an internet architect for Telstra. And came in and worked on Big Pond Cable in the first instance.
And that was really in the early days of Big Pond, at a time when internet usage was really starting to boom, to move out of the, I guess, the university space and into the residential and an enterprise internet as well. That must have been really fun times.
Yeah, it was pretty interesting. And Telstra was a pretty good early mover in the broadband area with the cable internet offerings, and that made for some pretty interesting work.
How rapidly was the tech stack changing during those times when you were architect at Big Pond?
Look, it wasn't changing particularly rapidly. There was some strategic selection in the time that I was at Telstra on some new systems that weren't rolled out for some time. So on the network side, ADSL came in, and I found myself as the retail architect for ADSL. So the network technology was changing, but on the IT side, not a lot of change, sort of struggling to come up with more flexible options for getting things to market.
And did you have a real focus towards enterprise or residential, or was it really both?
Oh, no, it was completely residential in my time at Telstra.
Were you getting your first experiences with OSS and or BSS at that time with Big Pond too, or was it more network focused?
Oh, look, it was all about how do you fulfill a sure bill, these new broadband services as you take them to market, and trying to make that happen over the in situ systems that Telstra had at the time. So that was, as you can imagine, a bit of a challenge.
So there was no real segregation between Telstra's existing systems and Big Pond, so you didn't have a standalone stack for the ISP part of Telstra?
Well, prior to my coming in, Telstra had spun off Telstra Multimedia and then rolled out the Foxtel network and launched Big Pond Cable and then reabsorbed it back into Telstra. So that was prior to my time. In Big Pond, and that allowed them to get the new systems in place that were required to support the cable network and the Big Pond cable product. But they were pieces of infrastructure that were still coupled to the Telstra owner at the time, and then once reabsorbed, it became the internet program within Telstra.
Was most of it homegrown or off-the-shelf EMS type tools, or were you also using some of the products out there from a commercial off-the-shelf type product suite?
Oh no, most of it was commercial off-the-shelf.
Okay. Any names that we would be familiar with these days?
Oh, we did a lot of work on PIX firewalls, and then there were, and obviously the head ends came with the network vendors for cable. The ADSL network was all Nortel kit, and so there was certain EMSs that came in as part of those Shasta BRASs. There was
the infamous Shastas.
Yes. And there was a fair bit of work done by some different SIs that happened to have product. So HP was fairly heavily involved in the cable side. There was a collection of different things, but it was all working with different COTS components and stitching them together and integrating things to make it work.
Yeah, interesting. So I say infamous around Shasta because that specific product was, but generally speaking, I really loved working with the Nortel equipment because it was really well documented in terms of trying to interface to it. Were you operating down at that kind of level with your architecture, as in northbound interfaces off those systems and trying to stitch that together with the other systems you had?
It was all about how you'd fulfill Assure and build a product that you take to market. So, you know, I did the Shasta 5000 training as part of my role, and then looked at what it did, what exposed northbound, and scoped things out at a level so that we could then drive technical design. So, in part.
Yeah, right. So, going back a little bit even further, so your engineering degree was in manufacturing systems. Did you always have your eye on a career in telco?
No, I never.
How did that come about?
So, I went to uni wanting to design cars and then realised that that was pretty dead end in Australia, and then switched into a more generic manufacturing, and there was so much manufacturing going to China, and I finished uni in the during the recession in the early 90s, and found that the only way to get a job was to be prepared to either move to somewhere where I could get involved in manufacturing, or alternatively just work in IT. And I'd done a major in manufacturing management software and electives in local and wide area networking and the like. So I just worked in IT.
And it seems from that it is a fairly logical pivot to transition from that kind of bent along manufacturing systems over into telco.
Well, it was a long time ago, and the world was sort of moving off dumb terminals and the PCs at the time. So I was very, very much a part of that PC revolution and the introduction of local and local area networks into organizations, and got involved in setting up host gateways into IBM Midrange and VAX VMS systems, and I guess a range of different mid-range host environments that these enterprises were using to run their businesses. And so you would sort out a gateway and then put a local area network through an organization, and then replace dumb terminals with PCs. Was that sort of revolution. They weren't connected to the internet back then, right?
Yeah, absolutely. But fantastic how those early learnings also contribute to just a level of understanding that you may not necessarily get with networking today, where it wasn't plug and play. It was very, very detailed hands-on to actually get those systems to work.
Oh, look, the thing was so hands-on. I came out of my manufacturing degree and I took my thesis and I sold it to some job shops around Melbourne, and then found that in order for them to run the software across the factory floors, which had high electrical noise and some long distances, and fiber optics weren't really affordable for them, that we needed a solution to get the computer networks to work. And we actually wound up clocking down network speeds to make the Ethernet networks operate at a slower speed so they'd be more tolerant to distance and noise. So there was all sorts of little tricks going on to try and make LANs work back then.
So you talked about selling a software. So does that mean you were pretty much entrepreneurial straight out of the gate of leaving uni? Did you start up your own company to do that?
I didn't start a company. I just got permission from the university and sold my thesis to a couple of Melbourne job shops when I couldn't get a job.
Yeah, right.
It was the early 90s recession.
Yeah. Did that learning from doing manufacturing systems, did that possibly even give you an important alternative way of thinking once you did come into the telco space?
not something I've really given a lot of thought to, Ryan. I really saw the moving into telco and internet as a reset to the way of thinking. It did teach me how to set up IP networks and subnets and routes and all that sort of stuff that was necessary to become effective in the network architecture space once moving into an ISP.
And then obviously you made some really great learnings and so forth, and you were quickly hired away and then promoted to chief architect roles at Request Broadband and then AAPT. So AAPT is more of the full service telco, but in both of those roles, were you effectively looking after architecture of their ISP businesses?
Yeah, so Request Broadband was a case of being prepared to take a risk. So I was an architect in Big Pond, and my boss's boss, Phil Sykes, exited Telstra, and 3 months later emerged looking to resource the first competitive DSL company to get access to the copper phone network. I agreed to leave Telstra and started with him. So that sort of jumped me somewhat in my career, because I left Telstra for a company starting on the 1st of July, where the company had enough cash to keep the doors open until the end of November. And we were successful at building a prototype network and systems and on board and integrate with Telstra for acquisition of ULL over that time frame. And as a result, the backers then came in and put the money in required to build the business. And we built the Request DSL business. The AAPT story is a bit different. That was actually, Digit's role was not really prominent at the time, but that was Digit's first major client. And I played the role as the CTO of the small to medium enterprise business unit of AAPT as part of that engagement. So there was an outsource of their SME business unit. So it was an unusual arrangement put together by John Stretch, the CEO of AAPT at the time.
Fantastic. What sort of time frame was that the Digit officially was founded to support that?
So Digit started in, really the activities of Digit started in 2004 when Request was acquired, and I was no longer employed by Request. It was really interim consulting activities while I looked for the next job. And I did that for about 9 months. And after 9 months, I had 23 staff, and it became clear that it was a long-term commitment, not a short-term fill-in.
Absolutely. It's an amazing jump for a startup business. Really impressive. And to help listeners understand the gravity of the role, do you recall how many subscribers you had under management under the iProvide brand at that stage?
My main focus was the new generation converged services that we were delivering over IP. We were really bringing VoIP in for the SMEs and at the same time providing it as part of a bundled service. In order to achieve that, we had routers that we were pulling in from Taiwan that had modified firmware to meet with our QoS requirements and manageability requirements. We were connecting around 100 new business locations a month with the iProvide Office offering, and that provided either a hosted VoIP or handoff to PABX via POTS, ISDN basic rate, ISDN primary rate, or IP connectivity. It provided a private VPN service between locations for an SME, and it provided an internet access with a whole bunch of controls over the way that internet service was being delivered. So it was a standardized offering to deliver that triple play, if you like, to SME customers.
Really interesting. And the entrepreneurial spirit must have already been bubbling away within you too as you formed Digit. Was that are you able to describe what you had in mind for Digit in those formative years, or was it more responsive to the opportunities that were popping up?
Look, it was mostly responsive to the opportunities. We found that we had an opportunity to build a services business of some scale, and that came about off the reputation that we'd built in the Request ESL business and the impact that we had on the market in the Request ESL business, but also the management team from Request who really popped up in leadership across Australian telco after the Request business had been acquired. So there are a bunch of people that saw me as a go-to to get IT work done within the telcos.
Yeah, I mean, especially that unbundling of the local loop, the ULL that you referred to before, so Request being the first of those, but the first of many, there wouldn't have been a lot of other skill set around and you would have really been leading the way with that.
Yes, and one of Digit's early customers was Optus XYZ, so their DSL network. They'd they were in a race with Request DSL to get competitive DSL to market, and they looked at with some envy at the systems that Request operated with and the kind of customer experience that we're able to deliver. And then once I'd made the transition into a consulting business, they hired us to build their new system for DSL fulfillment, as an example.
And I assume Request's budgets that you would have had to play with would have been much smaller than Optus's and the Telstra Big Pond network at the time, or the systems to support the network.
Oh, yes, they were small budgets, but they were enough.
So you would have obviously been doing some quite innovative stuff. And again, that's where the attraction of those other customers would have been.
Correct.
So we'll come back to Digit a little bit more. But first, I'd like to talk about your role in designing and building NBN's earliest OSS and BSS stack. Now, it's not often that you really get to design a Greenfields OSS BSS for a Tier 1 telco. That must have been a fantastic role to pick up as head of systems architecture and tech. A massive opportunity, but perhaps also a massive set of challenges to boot.
I was very fortunate. I had a marriage breakdown, and my good friend Gary McLaren was the CTO, had picked up this role for this new entity, CTO of NBN, and so I was able to apply for a role to built the systems, and it was a greenfield opportunity, and was able to really sort of study the field and work out industry best practice and put some industry best practice into place. Now, we'd already been heavily engaged in this NBN process prior to that. I was chair of the operational working group for Communications Alliance, driving the operational requirements for the NBN prior to the formation of NBN Co. and was putting pressure on behalf of the RSP community, essentially, as to what the NBN should look like from an RSP's perspective to integrate with. We had a number of customers we were looking after that were that had a vested interest in getting a good outcome so that the NBN could be nicely operationally integrated. So coming from that position of asking for all of these requirements to be met, then transitioned into a you come and design and build something to meet them.
Fantastic. What a great story. I hadn't been aware of the Comms Alliance relationship, actually, but it did have a particularly influential role to play in the formation of NBN too, didn't it?
Yes. So Comms Alliance was, John Stanton at the time had a real focus as NBN was coming up in pulling the service providers together and trying to stamp out what the NBN should be, what the network architecture should look like, what it should be like to integrate with, and just to try and represent the interests of those communication service providers that he has as members. And they're an organization that's been very, very focused on technology at certain times, but then often swing back into regulatory issues and make that the primary focus. That was one of the times when the technical side was of great interest, just a bit like when they sorted out the local number portability. Similar era for them.
That would have been a brilliant starting point, that you already knew the requirements so deeply, having worked through it and then being dragged across to do the delivery on it. Can you remember what your first planks or the mindset of the first planks of when you were building that OSSBSS strategy for NBN? What did you form it on? Was it, say, TM Forum, or did you have other ideas in mind in those early days?
Well, I was looking for information that I could get from other markets that had done a similar thing. And the standout example at the time was the UK market, and which Australia was to some extent copying in setting up a national broadband network and going for a structurally separated approach. So BT Openreach had really exposed their service provider interfaces in 2005. So that had been sort of 4 years earlier, and the that had a bit of experience. And the TM Forum got in. I used the TM Forum as a way to broker the discussions with different service providers in different places around the world, but wound up getting very deeply engaged with the architects at British Telecom in terms of what their experiences were. So that experience fairly heavily informed it.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And Openreach was such an innovator in that space, and they did lead a lot of the global thinking in that regards. So in the 18 months that you were in the role with NBN, what were some of the things that you, your greatest achievements, maybe the problems you overcome and what you're most proud of during that period that was so influential in the Australian telco industry?
Oh, the 18 months at NBN, we were going very hard for those first 18 months. There was a very detailed architecture put together, breaking the problem into five different domains. And those five domains of the architecture then flowed through to the way NBN sourced its systems so that we could get a very pointed about who had the capabilities to meet requirements in each of those five domains. That architecture was an interesting architecture, but was also quite an achievement because it allowed us to break a big problem down into parts so that we could solve for it. We defined an information model across the lot, and we built and our information model was based on the TM Forum SID, and that extended that model then drove the services that each of those five domains exposed to each other. So in doing that, it kept the architecture reasonably well componentized and ensured that there was a good deal of reusability. There was also some great achievements when we came in that architecture and the realization of that architecture, in that we achieved flow through to network for locations that were already connected to the network. So you could get real-time fulfillment, which when the resources existed at the customer premise was almost unheard of in those times. And having that clean architecture and that division of responsibility allowed us to systematically execute on a quite complex sourcing process. So we ran an RFI, there were over 80 respondents. It needed to be a public process because of the nature of it. A huge amount of stuff to sort through, but with clarity on what we were looking for and what was important, and we were able to do that in a very systematic way. And then of the results of the RFI, run an RFP, which was got to another level of detail with those that were of real interest, and a point, and then roll out first phase. There was the race was on as network was being built. We needed to get some decisions made in physical network inventory in advance of other decisions, because the last thing you need to do is build network and not have good inventory records for what you've built, and get some integrity in the process as the network built was going on. So getting that architecture stood up and driving that sourcing process, and then the first phase of build was all an achievement over the, in that time window. And there was a lot of process that needed to be conformed to, given it was a big government investment.
And the reference to conformance there I find really interesting as well, because to me, at least, it felt like a lot of the vendors in OSSBSS land were just starting to come across more to the likes of the SID and ETOM as some of their grounding points, where previously, I guess, there was more of the claim of conformance, whereas by that stage, it was starting to be an actual conformance. So did you find that using the SID, did most of the vendors conform quite easily to the SID, or were there still a lot of teething issues with that level of standardization?
There was no more teething issues conforming to the SID as there would have been conforming to anything else.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
So in adopting a standard rather than inventing our own, we were hopefully just heading the NBN down a path of greater reuse. And we're also providing a reason why the vendors would want to invest in conformance, because there'd be potential business upside for them beyond just the one engagement if they're conforming to a standard rather than something that we'd invented. So it was very keen on that as an idea. It was also obvious that in a marketplace, that if you could conform to a standard, the marketplace could grow to being more than just a marketplace where one access company is providing lots of service providers. You could potentially then have different parties buying and selling different things from each other. Mm. So the product payload on that NBN B2B was always abstracted, and it was always defined as SID metadata, so that it could work on any particular product. So we were angling for something that was reusable.
Mm. Oh, and obviously the lowering of the tech debt that follows with just by having everybody on that same development path.
Yep. And I guess the other thing is I was always very keen to see Communications Alliance own as much as possible of those industry interfaces rather than them being NBN's interface. I had a preference to the model being one of the industry agreeing on the interface and the industry using the interface, and anybody else in the industry that wanted to use the same interface spec for a different purpose could just pick it up and use it.
Yeah, and that just promoted that potential for growth through the whole of the Australian comms industry that wanted to interface to NBN. So, yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Well, that was the thinking at the time.
Yeah, I know you've had a particular focus on BSS tools like fulfillment, billing, catalog, etc. at Digit. But at NBN, you're also implementing, obviously, the operations and assurance tools. You referred to P&I, the inventory tool, and resource management so much as well. Would you call yourself an OSS guy, a BSS guy, or perhaps a mixture of both?
Oh, a bit of everything. You can probably appreciate I've worked as a network architect and then moved into the OSS systems. And then I've had the good fortune of working as in Telstra as what they called as an internet architect at the time. Mm. And that was really a turnkey, how do you deliver an internet service, which then pulls it all together. So I got to be very end to end.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a great segue back to Digit as well. As much fun as the NBN role must have been, it was a structural reorg around that time, as well as the burgeoning needs of Digit, forced you to refocus your attention back onto Digit in 2011. Are you able to tell us a little bit about Digit, maybe the scope of what you do, products, services, customer profile, etc.?
Yeah, so moving back into Digit in 2011, I really decided in my time at NBN that Digit's focus should be different, that we should become a product organization. Mm. And there were a number of my colleagues at Digit that were of exactly the same view. You know, we had a lot of technical talent in the business who were looking at the systems that were available in the market and the kind of consulting work that we were doing, and saying, well, we could build something better than this. And so when I came back into Digit, we sort of took a strategic decision to not promote the services side of our business, and so not invest in growing it, and instead invest in an R&D project to develop the Telflow product that we have in market today. So Digit was really operating with, I think, 5 service provider customers at the time. And we had some good size customers, and we'd be doing a mixture of some fixed price work as well as some T&M body shopping type services. And it was also pretty clear that the Indian companies were really ramping up in that space. Very difficult to differentiate yourself when you're supplying people. Whereas if you really are better at something, you should be putting together a product, and as a proof point. And we decided, and so we invested a significant amount of money over a reasonable time window to build a product.
And having the revenues to support it as well from the services side of the business would have been a fantastic, injection of revenue and support for the product development.
Yes, and so there was a deliberate decision to cap the growth of the services side so that it could spin off the cash that was required for the product development, which was quite separated from the services side of the business. We did not develop the product for a specific customer. We developed the product as a product.
Mm. And there were quite a few products available on the market that sort of sat in a similar space, but were there particular gaps in the ability to deliver for customers, and I guess particularly borne out from your experiences at NBN that you built the product objectives around?
Look, the use of metadata was fairly limited in the early stages. It was with a lot of those older systems, you'd have to make the decision about how performant you wanted the system to be versus how configurable you wanted it to be. You needed to trade one off against another.
And a lot of the functionality was baked in back then, wasn't it? So that would have given you a lot more flexibility by choosing that architecture.
Yeah. So there was a new IT technology emerging, in particular in the database space, the NoSQL technology and related and similar technologies that have come since that do a much better job of managing that metadata, that dynamic data. So we're able to take the TM Forum SID and say, well, let's have it all extensible via metadata. So all of the different things that would need to be configured for different behavior end to end could be metadata extensible. And so we're able to abstract all of those elements and then drive them from a catalog and then use NoSQL technology to store all that metadata, all that dynamic data. And with the way NoSQL technology worked, it allowed that to be a lot more performant. We're able to push the consumption of a lot of that metadata all the way to the user. So we'd be rendering screens from metadata objects, from combinations of metadata objects that would be pulled back from the catalog, and that would happen locally. So we're able to really break that old trade-off of is it configurable or is it fast, and we're able to do both.
Mm. And that rendering that you talked about allow you to develop customer portals or internal ops portals really quickly too, I imagine.
Well, we're able to deliver an out-of-the-box experience where if anything you configured in the catalog was automatically available in the portal and then for different users of the portal. So right from the early stages, we'd had customer roles as well as internal ops roles, etc. And you'd get a different perspective of the same thing, depending on whether you're a customer self-managing or whether you're an internal operator. And the experience would be configurable to the extent that if you wanted to take something new to market, you could do it by configuring the catalog and not need to break into code.
Mm. Now we're nearly 10 years on from 2011, and yet those concepts that you've just talked about still seem relatively unique in the industry. It seems like you've still got a fairly big competitive advantage or differentiation strategy from a lot of the other products that are in a similar space in the market. You seem to have still a big advantage there.
Yeah, we're more catalog driven and more standards aligned than any of our competitors. And it's because we've been designed to be that way from the outset rather than trying to make that transition. Mm. You know, our Telflow Order Manager, after moving in late 2011 to setting up the R&D project, we delivered the Order Manager to market in 2014. And the CPQ was always part of the architecture, but took until 2018 before that was launched to market. It's takes a while to build these things comprehensively enough. I mean, a lot of the old software that we were competing with had so many features. Mm-hmm. And telcos, when they source, they'll give you a big list of requirements, and it's do you have this feature or that feature is a lot of it. So Building something that has the feature richness enough to be selected is not a trivial undertaking. And it's taken a while to also for the industry to get inspired to move to better architectures. So, and we've seen a real growth in the adoption of the TM Forum. We've seen the TM Forum open APIs come to bear. We were a very early party involved in the TM Forum open APIs. As soon as it became clear that these REST APIs were going to be the future, we've jumped on the TM Forum open API bandwagon and started contributing heavily into the TM Forum. Participated in the working groups, which is very difficult to do from Australia because a lot of the meetings can be at 2 or 3 a.m.
I can attest to that, the 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning meetings.
And then we've seen progressive adoption now to the point where almost every service provider sourcing activity is looking for conformance.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll get onto TM Forum a little bit later as well and dive into that. I also feel like time to market has been a really important metric for you and your customers, whether that's getting your solution up and running, getting new customer offerings to market, making future offerings easier to add, change, delete, getting a project done in time. Is that how you see it, or do you really look to other metrics? And perhaps what do your customers look for most when evaluating you and competitors?
So fast to market is a thing that gave us some really big breaks early on when we first took our products to market. So we found we're able to get onto some opportunities where some of the larger telcos in our region were looking to get new things to market quickly, and they're in such a hurry that they would actually give a non-brand, as we were at the time, a go, because they were in such a hurry to get to market, and if and we had a way to do it. So we wound up with a number of early customers where we took them to market extremely quickly. And then they've been able to benefit from some of those have set themselves up intelligently so that they can then take new products, continue to take new products to market quickly over those architectures.
And we're talking about often a lot of these vendors have got thousands and thousands and thousands of existing product lines or SKUs, I guess. And often those SKUs, I've heard stories of them taking 18 months, 2 years to get a new one to market. It was really an area that is just prime for massive speed up. And it seems like your approach has really helped to do that.
Yeah, so in the early stages of taking our software to market, we'd be seen as a point solution to solve a fast market problem, often by the larger telcos, but we'd be just solving a fast market problem. And the thing that's become obvious over time is the digital transformation is essentially the same problem when it's a big telco. So if you've got tens of thousands of really flattened out products and you need to take all of them to market because you're digitally transforming, then your ability to get to market quickly is key to being able to execute on a digital transformation in a reasonable time frame. And it's not about a product manager wanting to get something to market in the next 3 months. It's about an entire digital transformation being achievable in a reasonable time window when it's something big. And so that's something that's been playing out for us more recently as service providers realize the power of our approach.
Well, and also just that concept of if you've got tens of thousands of SKUs that you have to try and transform, everything else is downstream, or all the rest of the OSS BSS stack is downstream of that complexity. And so it's like a complexity multiplier for the rest of your transformation. So if you can kind of get that under control, it actually streamlines the rest of the transformation as well, I feel.
Yeah, and the key there is to have systems that can deal with rich products. So rather than everything needing to be its own product, to rationalize down to a simplified set of products And it's simplified in the sense that there wouldn't be as many of them, and you don't have, you don't need to choose which product for which job because it's really obvious. But within those products, those rationalized products, you have quite a deal of optionality. And so that you can collapse all your SKUs down into a sensible, well-modeled and flexible set of products, and then start doing some more intelligent things like being able to provide multiple offerings over the top of one access, for example, or having a structured way to deliver a complex multi-site enterprise solution with different value adds. Having systems that can model all these things in the metadata of the system makes all the difference, and the visual tools in the catalog make it then possible to then tackle the job of modeling new generation offerings to replace old flat SKU type approaches.
I guess the catalog's the key to that too, whereby you create the building blocks that you can then create the customer-facing services, the CFS, onto using the building blocks of the RFS or resource-facing services.
There's a number of big industry trends also going on here. I mean, this use of metadata in the, and catalogs to then be able to make it possible to model things that were difficult in the past, and then not just model how you present it to a customer, but model all of the different entities that you decompose to, as well as the decomposition itself. These are metadata-driven approaches that are then able to extend into the domain of other vendors. So we've had as the market embraces standards-based approaches that incorporate these concepts, we've been able to get some great integrations going with different partners, which is seeing service providers choosing us together, and the work that's been going on in the networks in new generation sort of software-defined networks or network function virtualization is really drawing a line as to what API exposure looks like out of those, out of that world, and allowing the network models from the network world to be exposed northbound into IT systems. And with our metadata driven approach, we can consume those as components and then use them to package things up, make them available to customers. Very similar thing for partner integration, being able to plug in a partner. You know, we've shown that plug and play is achievable between partners. We've done industry projects to prove it. We've engaged with some of our competitors and in that, because we think that the way that sort of USB for telcos to connect into each other is going to be achieved is by the vendors actually getting on board and working together to make it happen. Bespoke integration done by the telcos, I don't think is going to get there in is going to get a catalog driven approach together fully. I think they need a bit of vendor assistance. So that's a key part of the architecture. And then between different IT systems within the stack, you know, being able to integrate fulfillment and assurance systems. And there's been some really great assurance experiences built in different assurance platforms, all predicated on the inventory within those platforms being within the system itself. And so you've got to be able to have that inventory instantiated from metadata that's driven from a catalog. And you've got to be able to integrate that with the fulfillment systems that, or with the same catalog that the fulfillment system's driven from, if you want to be able to take something to market fast and then leverage some of those assurance experiences and so forth. So getting this sort of dynamic behavior allows you to then resolve that whole old world inflexibility of the telco systems.
And speaking of that flexibility, you talked a little bit about the ability for northbound IT systems to consume those APIs. So that kind of implies that the APIs are used for internal consumption. Are you seeing any indication of telcos making those kind of APIs also available for external consumption, becoming the true, I guess, the network as a service solution that the telcos can offer, just APIs as a contract?
Oh, look, a number of our customers do. They're offering the product level, the TM Forum product level APIs for their customers to integrate with. But in terms of adoption, it takes an A end and a B end. We've had a lot more traction on integration between partners, the whole thing of integrate the offerings of two vendors together. And then that makes the combination of the two more interesting propositions to telcos that are looking to put new systems in. There's been traction coming through there faster. You're in control of the A and the B end, essentially, when there are two vendors working together. But we've been doing TMF open API integrations between Vodafone Opco and Orange Business Services, for example, recently. And there's been integration between a number of our wholesalers and their domestic wholesale customers in some markets. And we've made the TMF open APIs available in a range of markets with varying levels of adoption. But the northbound APIs are available off our Telflow product. We have them included in our offering.
And you've talked a little bit about Telflow during the podcast so far. Relatively recently, you also bought the Inomial business that specializes in billing solutions. Seems to be a great fit. Are you able to describe some of the pros and cons of trying to dovetail two organizations into one across, say, the products, culture, client bases, etc.? Potentially, generically, if you'd rather not talk about the specifics.
Yeah, so the Inomial acquisition happened in 2018, and it appeared to be the right point in time to be acquiring Inomial. They were halfway through development of their new generation billing system. The old system had been an evolution of code that they'd had in the market since 1999, and they'd taken the decision to ditch the lot and rewrite it as a modern microservices SaaS architecture. And that modern microservices SaaS architecture has around 100 different microservices and really quite amazing scalability. And by grabbing a hold of a half-developed product, that allowed us to then seek out alignment between that product as it came to life and our Digitelflow CPQ and order management offerings, so that you could get a really seamless quote, order, bill experience if you use the products together. And really, what the outcome that we're looking for is that you define what you're offering and you drive it all through a CPQ, and there's this as much as possible price certainty up front, and you work all that stuff out at the quoting stage. And if there's any commercial changes through the order management process, that they're all dealt with through the process. And then at the end, the billing just happens. So a lot of the capabilities within billing systems have been about dealing with things that are maybe not so certain and not sorted out up front. We're really about seamless quote, order, bill, but where you sort everything out up front, that upfront configure in the configure price quote then drives things all the way through. And it's not just upfront. You might change that configuration as you go through the journey and it auto adjusts.
Yeah, that's a really important call out that I guess I hadn't thought of that in terms of that time to market too. But yeah, that thinking about billing as part of the design of product as well is a really important factor.
Yep, and drive it all from one catalog so that we can take the CPQ and order management and billing and provide a single catalog experience to take something new to market.
Yeah, brilliant. So OSS and BSS collect an astounding amount of data. And as CEO of a product company, how much of your decision-making would you say is data-driven in that role? Really the data that drives your decision-making on product strategy and things like that?
When you say decision-making, you're talking about the decision-making from our business strategy perspective or the decision-making in terms of fulfilling customer orders?
More of the former, so more around product strategy. So the direction that you're seeing, say, lots of orders come in via a specific way or particular APIs that are used heavily, right. And so enhancing product. Yep.
Sure. Yeah. So we're certainly able to pick up behavioral patterns and behavioral preferences. One, and when it comes to those digital channels, there's one thing that we've learned is that the APIs, service providers that are choosing to integrate with other service providers through APIs all tend to cherry pick. So you've got to have equivalents through your with your out of the box portals and the APIs. And so we've got a dynamic portal, and then we have all of those services exposed via the APIs as well. And that UI and digital channel equivalence is key, because you'll often find that a wholesale customer will be using the portal, but there'll be something, one particular thing that they do a lot of, and they'll do an integration just around that one thing. So they can be very opportunistic in their behavior. And then we've also found that that omni-channel result to be important when providing digital channels into other worlds or other environments. So for example, we have a Salesforce app, and our Salesforce app is not one where we put our entire stack into the Salesforce world. We just provide essentially a UI experience within Salesforce, and people can work on quotes and orders in the Salesforce world, or they can work directly on our native web UI, or they could work on a custom portal that they might have been developed that gives a particular view, or they might be integrated via the APIs, and that that sort of omni-channel experience. And we're finding that it's really about the customer being able to interact with their channel of choice. So being able to choose. So you think of the way we like to buy things from stores these days, you know, it's like, oh, maybe we want to walk in, maybe we want to order it online, maybe we want to click and collect. You know, it's the same sort of just giving the customer the ability to choose whichever they're most comfortable with. And our dynamic architecture's really played out for us there. So because we've got a very good set of libraries and an SDK for doing things like reading entities from the catalog and dynamically rendering screens, and we're able to resurface different channel experiences in different environments and build out bespoke portals or support others that are building out bespoke portals without needing to do a huge amount of development.
And it's a valid point you make there too around customer choice. So I guess here we're talking about two layers of customers as well. So it's giving the choice of the carrier the ability to use or to build on their Salesforce investment if they want, or build on APIs or whichever other mechanism, but also the in-store versus online type perspective of their customers that you mentioned as well.
That's right.
So we've talked a little bit about you being an active participant in the TM Forum. Is that an official role that you hold with them?
Not at this stage. I've just really just been a significant contributor. And, you know, I've in 2015, while we were working so heavily on the Telflow product and contributing to the API program, I was given the Contributor of the Year award by the TM Forum. And we've been very heavily awarded because we've been an early mover and big supporter of the standards, and they've been fundamental in the design of our products. I don't have an official role with the TM Forum, just been a big contributor.
Yeah, absolutely. A strong ambassador. And it appears that part of that has come about because it's been really mutually beneficial for both yourself and the TM Forum, that it appears to me, at least as an outsider looking in, that a big part of your product strategy has been designed around the flexibility that's been offered by TM Forum's frameworks and ODA and things like that.
Oh, yes, there. The TM Forum standards have been around since the 80s, and they've continuously evolved. And there's a lot of really great thinking in TM Forum frameworks, now ODA and the APIs. But then there's a huge amount of value in just getting everybody on the same page so that we can all interwork and become more effective in what we put the solutions we put together for telcos.
And early in the discussion, you talked about using your contacts through TM Forum to really make connection with Openreach as just one of those examples. Are you able to talk about some of the biggest benefits of being an active member and contributor?
Oh, there's been some huge benefit in that engagement with NBN. What I found was that the architects in British Telecom were believers in standards and helping the evolution of standards. And they were prepared to contribute quite a reasonable amount of time to even reviewing our specs before we published them. So, and the TM Forum coming in from the perspective of let's all get together and try to make sure everybody standardizes here sort of allowed all that to happen. The other benefits have been if you build something that where you've invented it then and it's just bespoke to you, that's probably okay if you're Google or Amazon or Microsoft, but if you're not, then it's better to build to a standard where others are going to find that others have the opportunity to build to the same standard and then interwork with you. And that partnering has been very powerful for Digit. For example, in our partnership with Sienna Blue Planet, we did a TM Forum Catalyst project back in 2018, and we showed how we could learn network models from the Sienna Blue Planet, and then we could use them to create offers and make them available to customers and then support a runtime experience and do all of that without writing a single line of code and drive that whole thing through a catalog. And we've now got 4 common customers with the Sienna Blue Planet, so that's a pretty good outcome. And we work with customers in Africa, Middle East, Australia, and there's one in New Zealand with Sienna Blue Planet. Being able to collaborate around the standard is providing a reason for a big organization like a Sienna to integrate with a smaller organization like Digit Systems. And in fact, Sienna's gone on and used that integration with us to then integrate with others. So they get reuse rather than, whereas previously, had I said, well, I've got APIs and they're my APIs, you should integrate with these, they would say, well, who are you? Whereas if the APIs are an industry standard, you can convince them to do it. And then you get the benefits of everybody being able to partner. So for the larger players in the market, they get to partner with some of the smaller innovators, and the smaller innovators get to partner with the larger players in the market.
So a couple of key call-outs there. One is the importance of Catalyst program. I think it's quite an innovative idea for a standards body to do, but that's probably, in my mind at least, one of the more valuable things that TM Forum does is those Catalyst programs of getting a carrier and a few vendors together to implement a real-world use case. And the other one is, I guess, you called out being a smaller company, being able to work with the bigger companies. And I really see that as one of the benefits of, it's almost like a marketing exercise of getting your brand well known out there in the industry based on all of the great work that you do for and with the TM Forum.
Yeah, so if you participate in the forum and then get into the Catalyst programs and you solve some of the industry problems that service providers around the world are grappling with, then that is a great way to attract a bit of attention. So, that's been a massive asset to us in a marketing sense. So. We'll get typically dragged in by architects within different service providers, are determined to solve those problems that they've seen all or part of the solution for in Catalyst demonstrations and the like. And that gets interests in what we do all over the world. And actually, at this point, I mean, Digit's got approximately 70 service provider customers now around the globe. And we've got customers in 18 countries, and we've sort of taken that global approach, go build to the global standards, prove new concepts out as they happen within industry, and take a global approach to the marketing off the back of that.
Oh, really important. Just one last one on TM Forum. Are you able to describe some of the big challenges that you feel are yet to be solved by our industry and what TMF's role could be in solving those?
Oh, the TMF has always got to jump on whatever the latest trends are to try and look relevant. So both that sort of metadata catalog driven and how do you get the right structures to deal with the complexity of telco and flexibility to deal with the complexity of telco. It's an old problem that most of the telcos still have, particularly in the more complex parts of their business, like in B2B. So from the enterprise space, for example, most of them just don't have enough structure to be highly organized in enterprise. So the TMF's still dealing with those things, but in the new arena, I mean, AI and dealing with architectural changes that come through advances in the networking side, like virtualization of networks and then 5G architectures and edge compute and so forth, how they all roll in. So you kind of have the finish what you started activities of the TMF and then balanced with the thinking in the new areas.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess continuing on from the theme more broadly than just TM Forum, what does the future hold for OSS, BSS and telco, and how are you specifically positioning for it?
There's a few trends here that are really clear. The telcos every year are more and more accepting of moving things into the cloud. Many of them around the world are constrained by regulation and some of the government security concerns over national assets and so forth, and they'll always be a part of that. So I think the future for systems for telcos is to have systems that can look after their customer data and their service inventory and achieve the best balance between those two, between those considerations. We're cloud first, so we push our cloud services in the first instance. And in fact, our billing system is our Inomial 7 billing system. The new one is cloud only. So that move into the cloud is obvious. As services move into the cloud and as the standards are more and more embraced and the APIs become truly open, then we're going to see marketplaces form. So there's some pretty interesting opportunities as some of those marketplaces form, and telcos might be looking at providers of IT systems from the point of view of the value that they bring in enabling those marketplaces or providing access into market, ready access into marketplaces, and not just the functionality of the IT system itself.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I guess as more and more of the BSS and billing, particularly probably more so than OSS, as they're moving more into the hyperscaler marketplaces, do you kind of see an opportunity that, so there's all these products in the marketplace and some of them not always advertised in the marketplace itself, but almost like that catalyst opportunity of saying, all right, if we get vendor and vendor and vendor and all aggregate together.
Yeah, it'd be really great if there was something like the TM Forum Catalyst program that was a bit broader. The TM Forum Catalyst program allows us to get together and collaborate and prove a few things and provide a bit of comfort to the potential first movers that this has been de-risked to some extent through through an industry proof project, and where the vendors are getting the benefit of the market exposure and so on that you get from doing it in that open industry forum. If you're able to do the same thing, where that's constrained is by those that participate in the TM forum. It's very much a telco IT systems type audience, and for these marketplaces to be really effective, they need to be a lot broader. And so the TMF's been making some initiatives to try and move into some of these areas, but to get those collaborations going, you've really got to provide immediate benefits in collaborating. And the secret to the Catalyst program has really been the exposure. The kudos you get and the exposure and interest you get from proving something new in the Catalyst program. Yeah. It's that public visibility.
A fair bit of that actually stems out of the connections as well, that For example, I imagine it was your connection with Sienna, or maybe with one of the carriers that allowed you to form that partnership to then have a crack at that particular catalyst.
Oh, well, actually, we were introduced to Sienna as part of that catalyst project.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're out to try and prove those things, the things that were proven in the project. We were looking to prove those things, and then mm-hmm. we were introduced to Sienna, who were well suited to playing one of the roles in the project. So we met them completely through the collaboration, and then developed it into something of commercial value.
Mm. So do you remember who actually triggered that? Was it at TM Forum? Introduction? Was it from the carrier side that led the catalyst?
It was the carrier side. So yeah. The carrier champion actually introduced us to Sienna, Blue Planet.
Fantastic. So you're getting towards the end of the podcast now. I know you're really passionate about bleeding edge tech. Are there any particular technologies, product concepts that we should already be using or hold great promise for the future, or that you want to play with but haven't had the chance to yet, perhaps?
I'm pretty excited about SD-WANs and edge compute and seeing where 5G architectures really land. I think the telcos have got networks that are bigger than just the radio networks, and I think some generalization of some of the concepts out of that the 5G world, so that they apply across the telco's entire network, makes sense. And so that's the stay posted. That's the purpose of our 2021 Catalyst project.
Mm, brilliant. Are there any other pearls of wisdom that you'd like to offer for people who are listening to the podcast, or anything particular that I should have asked but haven't as yet?
I think you've asked just about everything, right? This has been going for a while.
We have indeed.
Yeah. I'm from an architecture background, and I'm really all about reuse, which is why I really heavily embrace the standards. And I think that I don't like reinventing the wheel. I don't like working on solving something that I think somebody else has solved before. And I think as an industry, we've invested so much energy just resolving for the same problems over and over and over. And this has been a bit of a never-ending circular thing. And I think I'm pretty excited about the future, because I'm seeing better convergence of standards and more embracing of the standards. And I think we can put an end to wasting our time on the old problems through standardization, and so that we've got the energy to focus on the new.
I couldn't agree more. Basically, a book called E-Myth Revisited was a real eye-opener for me in terms of repeatability, reuse, and the efficiency that you can drive through. If you've got something that's repeatable rather than ad hoc, then you can apply continual improvement to that as well. So, yeah, absolutely. It's something really important for the industry. And I kind of wonder whether that is actually going to be led by product-driven companies as opposed to the services-driven companies, who it's in their best interest to do the same thing over and over and get paid for it multiple times, as opposed to a product company which just wants to use the same thing, use the same product, and have it used consistently across many customers as well.
Yeah, well, there's that commercial motivation is a big, big factor. There's also the ability to execute, where you want an API that can be reused for any given product, then that requires that it's catalog driven and that there's some metadata
robust
involved.
And flexible.
Yep. And it's too big an undertaking to tackle in the short time frame expectations that a telco will have for a particular product initiative. Mm. So if you look at a telco project to take something new to market, the ambition of in terms of time frame will be too tight to build something that sophisticated. Mm. And so there needs to be some underlying product investment to make it happen.
Brilliant. Just the last one of a hell of a lot of fantastic points that you've made today, Greg. So really appreciate you coming on. And if people wanted to continue the conversation, where can they find you?
Ping me on LinkedIn is probably the easiest way to chat with me.
Hmm. Fantastic. And I'll include that in the show notes. And thank you very much for coming on. It's been really insightful for me and hopefully for the audience as well.
Thanks for having me, Ryan.
And thanks very much for the audience for listening in, and I hope to get you another episode very soon. Thanks for listening to the Passionate About OSS podcast. You can find more episodes, more than 2,500 blogs, and our contact details over at passionateaboutoss.com.